Good afternoon. It's 4 o'clock and you're listening to Public Radio KCBX. Welcome to Issues and Ideas. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, licensed marriage and family therapist, educator, wife, and mother. And for the last 4 years, I've been known as the reluctant therapist. And today, we bring the conversation live and invite your participation as we explore various issues regarding mental health and how we can, as individuals and as a community, take charge of our emotional well-being and improve the quality of our lives. I'm so excited for the opportunity to bring these conversations to the community and open up a dialogue regarding how we're all feeling about the state of our collective mental health. And it's my hope that if we can open ourselves up and talk about those things that we worry about, that we feel less than about, that we feel sad about, that we could, if we can be real about the struggles that we all face, then maybe we can set a new course for not only our own mental health and our well-being, but also for the well-being of our community. Because we all, as humans, spend so much time trying to look like we've got it all together that we end up building walls between each other. We assume that everyone else has got their lives all worked out, that actually we're the only ones who don't. But the truth is we all struggle. We all worry. We all wonder how this whole life journey is supposed to work, and yet we've conditioned ourselves not to talk about it to each other, to keep those aspects of ourselves which make us feel vulnerable or seem less desirable hidden from each other and often hidden from ourselves. But that's how we get into trouble emotionally and mentally. And it's all of these things that we don't allow ourselves to share, all of the secrets that we keep that make us sick, diseased, isolated from each other, which is sad and ironic because we live for connections and relationships. We live to feel love and to give love. And yet, it's all of the hiding we do of our true selves that often prevents us from making real connections. So in a few minutes, I'm going to be opening up the phone lines for your comments, questions, and concerns. You can reach me at 781-3875. I welcome your thoughts and feedback, and I look forward to expanding this conversation, to hearing what's on your mind today. Because when I started this program 4 years ago, I was actually motivated by a lot of the changes I'd seen in the mental health services that I'd actually observed working in the county for 12 years. As mental health professionals, I'd noticed that we'd quickly started moving away from a client-centered model of personal care and actually started focusing less on talk therapy as our primary focus of treatment and moving more towards a more Western medical model of treatment, which is based on this pattern of recognizing symptoms, finding a diagnosis, and creating a treatment plan, which wasn't an entirely negative change, actually, because therapists have struggled for years to gain respect in the medical community. And one of the ways to improve the perceived value of therapy was to standardize treatments in such a way that success could actually be measured. Unfortunately, this movement to the Western medical model also opened doors to the co-opting of talk therapy. It actually started to be taken over by big pharmaceuticals, by managed care, by insurance companies, large bureaucratic agencies, all of which are incapable of really addressing the needs of the individual and all of the unique nuanced details of their care. I mean, let's think about it. Big pharma promised relief in a little pill, right? A capsule. The insurance companies promised that healing was possible in 12 sessions. And the state agencies said relief would come from 50 minutes sitting in a sterile room with an often overworked and undertrained intern who was then flooded by reams of paperwork. So my reluctance to continue working under these constraints is probably obvious. We really, as a group, as professionals, weren't allowed to help many, if any, of our clients for any long period of time to get to any real place of sustained health. But worst of all, we actually were making our clients dependent on this type of mental health care, forever limiting their abilities to actually fully function with confidence and independence outside of the system, unmedicated, and with the necessary coping skills and strategies to be the primary authority in their own lives and care. Because isn't that always our goal, right? Is that we want our clients, we want our patients to heal and to feel whole and to be able to function outside of any sort of managed care or treatment. So my goal and my hope in doing this show, Becoming the Reluctant Therapist, has always been that if I spoke out often enough, if I spoke out loudly enough, that I might be able to shake some of those fundamental principles that have been guiding the mental health community and challenge the status quo in such a way that we might actually start moving toward a model of healing. But as in all things, I guess, it's been a much larger challenge than I ever imagined. And when I first set out, I was reluctant to be part of a system that I viewed as no longer serving the needs of the individual, but instead in many ways was pandering for the approval of the medical community by joining the Western medical model approach of identifying symptoms, creating a diagnosis, and applying a standard treatment plan. Which, don't get me wrong, works really well when treating diabetes or setting a broken bone. But the same model doesn't really translate well when we're dealing with chronic depression or trying to heal a broken heart. 4 years ago, I was certain that the backlash against big pharmaceuticals and all of the over-medicating of patients would come to a head, and we would turn the course back toward a more holistic approach to addressing mood and emotional issues. But instead, we've experienced incredible growth in the use of medications for treating relatively normal, albeit uncomfortable, but still normal transitions and experiences in our lives. Just as it's become a common practice to overprescribe antibiotics for common viruses, we've found ourselves overprescribing mood stabilizers, to treat common life events. I'm going to be opening up the phone lines the next few minutes to hear your thoughts on these issues, 781-3875. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, the Reluctant Therapist here on Issues and Ideas in KCBX. And one of the greatest challenges in questioning the status quo is the sensitivity of the subject, because we are talking about mental health. And I found that the psyche is a scary place to dwell, and not many people want to talk about it because it's overwhelming to think about how the brain works or changes in the brain might work or how to help people that are struggling with different issues. It's risky to question medical science when it comes to dealing with mental health concerns because, after all, it's rooted in science. And we've built our healthcare system on the faith and trust we have in those who are more highly educated, who are smarter about our bodies than we are. We need to trust medical science when it comes to major issues, but at some point, when we have so little success dealing with our more common maladies, like, I don't know, mainly depression and anxiety, that I would hope we might be willing to open the conversation regarding alternative ways to address emotional issues. But let me make myself clear before everyone gets too concerned, because I'm not talking about major mental health issues, specifically psychosis in the form of delusions or psychotic breaks or schizophrenia. I'm not even talking about major chronic depression, debilitating depression. Because 1% of our population really struggles with such severe mental illness that we have to trust our medical professionals, the pharmaceuticals, and agencies to help families cope with these issues. But let's think about it, because major mental illness impacts 1% of our population. My concern is that we actually medicate 14% of our population, where only 1% really need the medication. So what are we doing for the other 13%? We're failing to meet the mental health needs by overutilizing medications and not utilizing talk therapy or other therapies that have proven to be as effective, if not better, in dealing with common mental health issues. So today, I want to talk about nurturing our own mental health in ways that will create stronger functioning and more joy in our lives. Because I believe it's imperative that we take back control of our emotional journey and stop expecting others to be the experts in our life experience. I actually love the potential of talk therapy to help support and guide and nurture the individual gifts and talents and abilities of my clients. But I think as professionals, in a lot of ways, we've lost our way. As clinicians and as consumers, when it comes to taking charge of our emotional well-being. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, the Reluctant Therapist. You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Radio, and we invite you to call in now at 781-3875 and join the conversation. I'll be here till 5 p.m. We can talk about different ways of approaching mental health, what's on your mind, what are your concerns about this? Because I think what we need right now most of all is a new perspective. We need a new way of telling our story in a way that promotes all of the ways that we actually are strong and capable and able, instead of focusing on all the ways that we feel broken and diseased. Because that's the model that we've been looking at lately for the last 10, 15, 20 years, is that we approach people in the ways that they're struggling, through their symptoms, instead of looking at the ways things are going well. Because ultimately, we're really just a product of the story we tell ourselves and the world about who we are. Do you see yourself as competent? As someone who can experience the full spectrum of emotions, from happy to sad to angry to frustrated? Can you feel depressed and sad when things happen, or anxious when you're worried? Or do you see yourself as just a sum of your challenges? Do you feel too fat? Do you feel too slow? Do you feel depressed, anxious, alone? Quite often, what we've found in therapy is that the most quick fix we have with our clients is to help them change that story they tell about him or herself. What do you think? A couple of things actually came up when I was thinking about this topic today and what we were going to talk about going live with the show. And one of the things that came up was how actually the world of psychology tends to, in ways inadvertently, fuel the cultural story we tell about ourselves as being clinically anxious or depressed. And I was looking over some of the many, many websites, and if you've looked online anytime recently, you'll notice that there are tons of websites talking about mental and emotional health. And the thing that seemed to stick out the most for me were the statistics regarding mental health and how frightening these numbers would feel to someone concerned about mental illness who dropped in on this site looking for answers and support. So one site that I looked at claimed that 1 in 3 or 4 people could be diagnosed with a mental disorder at any time, and that 57.4% of the population would suffer from a mental illness at some point in their lives. And at the end of the website, the tagline at the bottom of the page said, "If you don't think mental illness will impact your life, you're sadly mistaken." Yikes. Just reading that made me nervous, and I do this for a living, so I can only imagine how that felt for other people who drop in just trying to find answers and information about mental health. And one of the things you need to understand as a consumer is that this claim that 1 in 3 people could be diagnosed with a mental illness is a little overblown, because the word could means that not that you might be, not necessarily will be, don't have to be, but could be diagnosed with a mental illness. And if you've actually ever read the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, the actual Bible for therapists, if you've read any of the different disorders that are contained in the book, you would be concerned about your own mental health. I mean, I read it on a regular basis, and I'm concerned for my own mental health, because the disorders listed in there are so broad that anyone on any given day could feel like they could be diagnosed with multiple disorders. The symptoms and the criteria are so broad, it'd be difficult not to see ourselves in some of the disorders during certain times of our lives. The other problem with psych websites is the idea that half of us will suffer from mental illness at some time in our life. We need to think about that differently, because of course we're going to suffer from some sort of mental illness in our lifetime. I would venture to guess, that most of us will at some time, because mental illness is like physical illness, and that we all experience it in different points in our lives. Think about it. If you consider mental health in the same vein as our physical health, if you're exposed to certain flus or germs, you're going to get the flu. If you have bacteria in your system, you're going to get sick in some way. The same way as if you suffer a loss or a death or a trauma or crisis, you're going to respond. Your body is going to respond in some way, either feeling depressed or anxious or worried or losing sleep. Depression and the flu, I guess, are normal ways that the body responds to outside stressors, to disease, something that's caused the body to feel ill at ease. How we respond makes all the difference. So think about this. When you get the flu, you take to bed, you drink lots of fluids, you rest, you enjoy the tender care of those who love you, and then you trust that your body knows what to do and that it's going to fight off the disease, and you'll soon find yourself returning to full health, right? To fully functioning in all ways. So think about when you suffer a loss. It should be the same in dealing with anxiety and depression, the common mood disorders that are the result of feeling, being, thinking, functioning human beings. When you suffer a loss, you feel sadness, you feel anger, you feel anxiety, and often you can feel depression, feelings of depression. Those are normal emotional responses. And so if you take it easy, you get more rest, you eat well, rely on your support systems, and trust that your bodies and mind know how to heal, then at some point you're going to return to normal functioning. We may have to miss work, stay in, lay low, just like a physical illness, but if we trust our ability to heal, then we return to full functioning. Right now it's 4:15 and you're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, the Reluctant Therapist, with you today until 5 p.m. when it's time for the news from NPR's All Things Considered. Today we're talking about our emotional well-being and our emotional health and how we can start taking charge of our own emotional well-being, look for alternative ways to take care of our health, much in the way that we take care of our physical health. How do we take care of our emotional health? I invite your phone calls now to 781-3875. What do you think about this? What's on your mind? In what ways do you improve your own mental health in your life? I think that overall, we need to find more faith in our own ability to heal, to some ways trust our minds and bodies. We also need to do the things necessary to maintain, good mental health. Most of us work so hard to maintain our physical health. We need to focus on what helps us to maintain good emotional health. We need to build our emotional immune system so that we're prepared when emotional crisis comes up, and we need to be able to draw on our emotional reserves to cope, just like we exercise and eat well and take our vitamins to maintain a healthy immune system. For good mental health, we also need to exercise, eat well, sleep often. We also need to nurture healthy connections and relationships, to treat ourselves kindly, focus on those things in our lives that are going well, focus on our strengths. These things will give us more resilience when faced with the normal things that life sends us, like death or loss or disappointment or fear and worry. We can come back from all of these things. The only time we get into trouble is when we get stuck in one place, stuck in a pattern of depression, stuck in a pattern of anxiety, and have a hard time finding our way back. We don't like to feel depression and anxiety. We want to feel better. So what do you think? Give us a call at 781-3875. Hi, Nick, you're on the air with the Reluctant Therapist. Are you there? Nick? Say hi, Nick. Are you there? Hello? We'll put Nick back on hold for a moment. Your thoughts about this, 781-3875. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, the Reluctant Therapist, and we're talking about how we deal with emotional issues and physical issues in much the same way. And if we can build our healthy emotional immune system, we'll be better apt in dealing with normal functioning problems of our daily life and of our own emotional life. Dealing with these issues is what actually talk therapy was really meant for.
Hello?
Oh, are you there, Nick?
Yes.
Hi, how are you? This is
Elizabeth. Thank you very much for taking my call.
What's on your mind today?
Well, I'd like to talk about adults or parents with self-esteem issues or depression issues that have children, and how to avoid passing this on to the kids. How can we sort of stop it in its tracks, so to speak?
That's a great question, and thank you for calling in. One of the things that as therapists we look at are the patterns in family histories. Family systems therapists look at how what our family did impacts our children and the next generation, next generation. And so if you come from a family that tends to have mood disorders, the best thing you can do is, as adults, deal with those mood disorders yourself. Get into an exercise routine, eat well, deal with those issues that cause stress. And by modeling the ways of dealing with those mood disorders to your children, you help them be better able to cope. Because quite often we can't avoid those things in our life that cause us trouble, right? And we might feel depressed or have anxiety. But if we are able to teach coping skills to our children, we give them a leg up when they get into trouble of their own.
So that's a good suggestion. So you start with yourself, mm-hmm. and then you can model for your kids. if they're already in a situation where you feel that, you know, they're bordering on depression or have trouble in school, mm-hmm. do you go to the school? Do you try to do it yourself? Or how can we work that out? Well, it seems like you have two problems. You know, you have a kid that's troubled and yourself's troubled, and I'm finding out where to start.
Right, exactly. Thank you for your call, Nick, and I'll try to address that a little bit because it's kind of a big, broad subject. But when you see a child that's in trouble or struggling, you know, ultimately as a therapist, I want my parents to be the experts in how to deal with the children. So as a therapist, I want to help give parents the tools to work with their children, to deal with the mood disorders, to deal with where they're struggling in school. And then I really want to help them to have the skills to talk to someone at school, maybe work with the teacher or work with the counselor at school to come up with some strategies as a team. But ultimately, instead of giving our control over, you know, to the experts, to actually utilize the experts to help go forward. I really appreciate you calling in, Nick.
Well, thanks very much. I think the topic is terrific.
Thanks. Thank have a great much. Day. Hi, we're looking for Nina in Rio Grande. How are you?
Fine, thank you.
Whoops, did I lose you? Hi, is this John in Morro Bay?
Yes.
Hi, this is Elizabeth Barrett, the Reluctant Therapist. What's on your mind today?
Well, I just had some, you know, feedback or thoughts about what you're relating physical health and mental health. And, mm-hmm. you know, in some ways it feels a little disempowering because for many of us or many of the people that we interact with on a daily basis, they say to themselves, well, I feel like I'm getting the flu. Like, I feel like I'm getting sick. Mm-hmm. And that belief system completely colors how they're going to feel. Yes. You know, people who believe that they're going to be healthy are more likely to be healthy.
Yes.
So to say to yourself, you know, to relate mental health and have it compared to physical health, I feel like they're two completely different things, that our belief systems and how we feel is bent on what we think. Our thoughts are much more powerful than any physical, you know, state that we're experiencing.
Well, so. I'm kind of confused, though. How would they not relate, though? Because if you say we can think ourselves, right, to health, if we believe we're getting sick, sometimes that helps to bring it on. Why wouldn't right. our mental health be the same? Our beliefs about whether we're depressed or anxious people can propagate that feeling of being depressed and anxious, just as our belief that we're healthy, strong, and capable. Am I missing
Correct.
Your point?
I agree with you as well, but, you know, your premise earlier was, you know, I'm reading through the DSM and I'm seeing all these things. Mm-hmm. You see what you believe. You get, you know, what you see is what you get. It's what Wilson used to say. And so it's one of those things that if you're believing it, you're going to have it rather than, you know, this physical thing precedes anything that I'm believing.
Yes.
So as long as we continue to propagate a belief system that says, you know, our physical well-being, we need to take care of our physical well-being. No, we need to take care of our mental first, and the physical will follow regardless.
I like the way you say that.
Yeah.
And are you familiar with Bruce Lipton's work in Biology of Belief? And,
I am.
Okay. And so that's kind of my premise also, is that we actually can alter the state of our genetic code by our belief system. And that's
Certainly.
What I'm trying to move for. Thank you okay. so much for calling. Any other thoughts?
No, I appreciate your topic. It helped me today. I needed that.
Oh, good. Well, I appreciate you tuning in. Keep listening.
Great.
So if you'd like to call in and join the conversation, this is Elizabeth Barrett with Issues and Ideas, 781-3875. And we're looking to San Francisco. And is this Brian?
Yes, it is.
Hey, Brian. Thanks for calling in. What's on your mind?
I really appreciate your podcast or your live cast today.
Thanks.
I just wanted to follow up on a question that, you know, came to me from listening to you today. You spoke a lot about exercises that we do to keep ourselves physically fit.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to get your thoughts on exercises or actions or things that we can do to keep ourselves, you know, mentally healthy and mentally fit, you know, especially like early in the morning when you wake up and, you know, all you think about is all the things you have to do today and all the stress gets piled on.
Mm-hmm.
And then similarly, when you go to sleep at night and all you can think about is, you know, the anxiety of the next day and all the things you have to do, like what steps or actions or specific exercises can you do to, you know, make yourself feel less anxious or more comfortable?
Thanks for calling in, Brian. I love your questions. You know, there are some really specific exercises we can do that are so simple that we often ignore them or blow them off as not being important. But the most simple thing you can do every day is start off your morning taking 5 deep, slow breaths before you get out of bed. Just taking the act of taking the breath, counting in your inhalations and your exhalations, try to get a nice slow rhythm to the breath, just 5. And you'll find your heart rate at first might speed up a little bit, but after the second or third breath, it starts to calm down and it helps you feel focused and more settled. And believe me, try it, because it takes more discipline to spend 3 minutes taking 5 deep breaths than you'll imagine. And then aside from that, you know, I love the idea of meditation if you have the patience for that. You know, actually the physical exercise of going for a brisk walk for 20 minutes first thing in the morning also can help settle and center yourself so that it's easier to cope. It's amazing the correlation between our physical actions and helping to settle our mental responses. But I encourage you to try just one small thing first. Brian, try the breathing, the five long deep breaths in the morning. And then again at night, if you can do it twice, that's great. But start off just one time a day and see how that sets up your day. And I appreciate your call. And is this Jackie? You're on the air.
Yes, I'm here.
Hi, thanks for calling.
Hi.
What's on your mind?
I was calling because yesterday I read a really interesting article in the Wall Street Journal about Alzheimer's disease and how a lot of people are being misdiagnosed with Alzheimer's when they're taking antidepressants, anti-anxiety, and even antihistamines or antibiotics. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you had heard anything about that, but it was a really interesting article, I think, on Sunday in the Wall Street Journal. And I thought, you know, maybe that's some positive news for our collective mental well-being if people are starting to pay attention to the amount of medications we're on. And I just wanted to kind of get your thought and say thank you for doing the show.
Thanks so much for calling in. And, you know, I didn't read that specific article, but I think what's important is that we're starting to find out more often how the medications that we're taking are not benign. You know, we think we're taking something that's going to impact one part of our body, and then we see how it's impacting all different areas of our lives. So it is important that we start to realize that if you're taking a mood stabilizer, we don't really know the long-term impact in anyone's individual body. We know what our short-term goal is for the mood stabilizers, which is why they're effective for short periods of time. But when we're on things for a long period of time, we don't know how that interferes with our own normal development, what other things it can trigger, how it impacts our memory, how it impacts our functioning. So I really appreciate the insight on the article, and I will look for the New York Times. And hi, Jim in San Ardo. You're on the air with Elizabeth Barrett.
Oh, hi, Elizabeth. Yeah, this is Jim in San Ardo, and I just I've found a workable way of actually exercising the mind, mm-hmm. and some friends of mine have experienced very good results with this too. I guess you may be familiar with L. Ron Hubbard of Dianetics.
Yes.
The Dianetics, the Modern Science of Mental Health. But he also wrote a book called Self-Analysis, which actually contains exercises that one can do, say, 10, 15 minutes a day.
Mm-hmm.
And I was particularly interested in what you said about focusing on the good times in one's life,
mm-hmm.
and how you can kind of build a mental resiliency against some of the other, you know, odds and ends that happen to you.
Yes.
And that is what this book does. And it's available pretty far and wide. You know, it's available on Amazon or even at the local library.
But
it's very easy thing to do.
I really appreciate you calling in with that, because any tools that we have and techniques, I think, are really important, because I think that we've started to hand over so much of our functioning to experts who don't necessarily know what our daily life schedule is or how we're going to fit things in. And I think the thing that's interesting is when we try to incorporate new things into our lives, it's important to start with something really simple and small, like taking 5 breaths or focusing on 5 positive things that are happening in our our life every night to kind of build the resilience instead of trying to jump in and do something huge right away, because that can oftentimes feel overwhelming. I appreciate the call. It's right now, it's 4:30, and this is Central Coast Radio, KCBX. I'm the reluctant therapist, Elizabeth Barrett, with you today for Issues and Ideas. And I appreciate all of your phone calls and participation. We're going to be here till 5 o'clock today. If you'd like to call in and share your comments, it's 781-3875. Funds for this program are provided by Chaucer's Bookstore in Santa Barbara, hosting book signings from a wide variety of writers. For a complete schedule, the website is chaucersbooks.com. Funds are also provided by the Chumash Casino Resort in the San Ynez Valley. The Chumash Casino offers 24-hour gaming and a luxury hotel and spa. And for more information, contact chumashcasino.com. Also, coming up at 5 o'clock today on KCBX, it's news from NPR's All Things Considered. Today, Robert Siegel talks with two moderate Republicans, former Congressman Mike Castle of Delaware and Tom Davis of Virginia, about whether that wing of the party can actually survive. In years past, the party had a component referred to as Rockefeller Republicans, named after former Vice President Nelson Rockefeller. The group tended to work well with middle-of-the-road Democrats. That story and more will be coming up in a half hour on All Things Considered here on KCBX Public Radio. Till then, you're with me, Elizabeth Barrett, the reluctant therapist, talking about mental health and how we can take back our own mental health, take charge of our well-being and functionality, and get away from this relying on external experts and medications. And I'd like to talk to Barry in Santa Maria. How are you doing, Barry?
Good. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks for calling in. What's on your mind?
Well, I was curious what your thoughts are as you're talking about how sort of big pharmaceutical has stepped in to sort of overpower our own coping with mental disorder and mental health, et cetera, mm-hmm. That I feel personally, I guess, that over, say, since the 1950s, that as new work styles have developed and the current mindset is sort of work, 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 mm-hmm. need things fast, that we've sort of lost outlets for our own recovery methods.
Yes. We don't really have the time, right, that it takes to recover. We have, you know, so few days on disability or so few days for sick time, and that it's almost like the constraints outside of ourselves have determined how long we're going to have to heal from the flu or emotional distress or loss, right?
Yeah, I know that with my dad, for example, that he won't take days off of work for vacation just in case he ends up getting sick.
Right, to save up for those times of desperation.
Yeah.
And then unfortunately, without the mental health days off, you end up getting sick more often.
Yeah, because of the stress levels lowering your immune system and such. But, my thought was more along the lines that, you know, we don't have the same outlets. I mean, a lot of people back, say, 40, 50 years ago, it was a lot easier to go out and figure out some way to sort of relieve yourself of stress or take care of your mental state, mm-hmm. and say, you know, recover.
Yes.
That stress, depression, slight issues here and there were easily fixable. I know from personal experience due to, at one point I was diagnosed with a couple of mental disorders, but as it turned out, it was actually just insomnia. That I was very much thrown into the whole, well, you need medication kind of situation.
Yes.
And I was given three different medications within the first 2 weeks of seeing a psychiatrist, even though, as we found out months later, that the only issue was insomnia with underlying sleep apnea, that it had nothing to do with a psychological state. It was physical, purely. But, you know, psychiatry, I know that with a lot of psychiatrists that I've talked to, it's sort of a soft science versus a hard science. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I know that we ended up getting a second opinion because of how fast they were giving me medications.
so quickly. We tend to jump to the quick fixes. And I think in, you know, defense a little bit of our medical profession, I think they tend to jump to the quick fixes because we as consumers have started to demand, you know, feeling better instantly. Like,
exactly.
We don't like to feel badly for any period of time because we expect that we should be able to get up and do our normal routine and work 80 hours a week and run our 40 miles and, you know, do all activities and never have a glitch.
Exactly.
And so I think that's where we kind of got into this trap where our medical profession in some ways was responding to the consumer's demand to feel better instantly. And like you said, you know, that whole pace of our life is so accelerated that we don't have time to not only get better when we're not doing well, we don't have time to enjoy when we are feeling well.
Exactly, definitely. I mean, look at the rise of fast food, for example. We don't have time to sit down in a restaurant or even, for that matter, cook our own meals. We need to take home TV dinners.
Right.
Or, you know, go through the drive-thru.
Yeah.
And so we don't have time to really enjoy what's happening around us or even recover ourselves.
Yeah. Well, and I really appreciate your call on this issue because it brings up, you know, this idea of how do we deal with grief? What is our allotted amount of time for grief when we are feeling heartache? You know, we tend to start wanting to medicate people after 3 to 6 weeks after the loss of a death in the family. 3 to 6 weeks. Now, come on. How long should grief really last? You know, for most people, the whole reality of a death doesn't occur to you for 6 months. And then at 6 months, it hits you even harder and you really go into a deep state of grief, which feels like depression, which feels like all body functioning has come undone. But we, in our Western model of wanting to be able to get up and carry on with our life day after day after day, only allow a certain amount of time for grief and for loss. When we talk about heartache, when a relationship breaks up, I generally tell my clients, you know, you need to allow as much time for grieving the loss of a relationship as you are actually in the relationship. If you were with someone for 2 years, it might take you 2 years to fully recover. And there's a lot of processes along the way to getting there. Hi, Pat and Los Osos. What's on your mind today?
Well, I wanted to ask a question partly that centers around the process of meditation, mm-hmm. and I think a lot of our conversation, we could spend a lot of time on different topics and areas. I've been studying the work of Dr. Joe Dispenza and, oh, many, many others, Bruce Lipton that you mentioned, mm-hmm. and I've been tapped into the law of attraction and mm-hmm. many other areas of sort of self-help and ways of getting yourself aligned with the things that you're wanting to achieve in your life.
And, mm-hmm.
And everybody seems to focus pretty clearly on the idea of meditation being a way to manifest more of that space or state that you want to find yourself into mm-hmm. in order to accomplish these things. That you're hoping to accomplish in your life. And I'm wondering, is there a way of, I mean, you talked about earlier getting stuck, and getting stuck to the point where it's, like, difficult to even get into that place to begin a meditation, even if it's a guided meditation with a CD or something.
You know, what I find interesting when it comes to meditation or meditative practices, that we all have to understand our own style or our own way of finding our level of comfort. For some people, you know, walking is very meditative. You know, you can walk a mandala, a circle, and, you know, just let yourself kind of fall into the rhythm of the walking and the breathing and just being out, because it's hard quite often for us to still our minds in such a way that we can get into a meditative state. Swimming can be very meditative. You know, something as as repetitive as washing dishes or sweeping floors or raking the front yard or working in your garden. Anything that helps you bring your mind and your body together in the same motions is very healing. That's why we see such great success with farm-based programs helping people to heal in recovery of any sort of loss, is to get into the dirt and get their hands dirty and move with the plants and smell the air. That, you know, when we connect our minds and our bodies together in an action, it tends to bring very healing results. It raises our serotonin, increases our dopamine. It makes us feel like we're connected to the planet. Because the part that I really want to focus on is the connections piece, the relationships piece. You know, that the healing of our lives quite often has a lot to do with uniting ourselves with someone who becomes kind of our guide or mentor through the process of finding our way back to healing. That was the beauty of a therapist for so long, is that they became kind of that guide, that witness to our pain or to our joy in our lives. And having someone hear our story, having someone witness our lives becomes a very healing thing. And so I can't emphasize how important it is to work on your relational skills, your communication skills, your problem-solving skills, your speaking skills, so that you can make connections with others. Because if I've seen any loss in our culture and community, it's the amount of time we spend doing lots of things like work and exercise and going from place to place and having different activities. All of that busyness has taken away from our opportunity to really connect on a deep way with other people. And it's those interpersonal relationships that we all crave on a daily basis. We crave love, feeling love, and giving love. And it's when we hit emotional roadblocks that we most need to be able to lean on someone else. You know, whether it's a walking buddy or someone to have a cup of coffee with or your bowling league. I mean, we've lost a lot of those ways that we spent time in our leisure and have gotten much more isolated in front of computers, in front of television, in front of game boxes. Unfortunately, you know, they found that as little as 4 hours a week in front of a computer screen raises the incidence of depression for those who are working with computers. You know, we are social beings. So it's really important that we continue learning how to reach out and connect with others. Otherwise, we find ourselves dealing with our, you know, issues, our common feelings of depression, our common feelings of anxiety in ways that are more self-destructive, right? We get into drinking too much or eating too much or doing too much exercise or sleeping too much. You know, those quick fixes feel like they're going to help us, but they don't do anything in the long run. It's like jumping too quickly to antibiotics. You know, when really, if you just ride out your virus, your body's going to heal. We need to learn to slow down our pace and allow our minds and bodies to heal on their own time. And then work on that story you tell about yourself. Who are you? And that's why I want to have these discussions. That's why I was passionate about bringing the Reluctant Therapist to the live call-in show, because if we can talk about those things as a community, those things that we usually are too embarrassed to talk about, or those things that we feel like we need to hide, if we say these things out loud, if we talk about our struggles, we talk about how tough it is to pay your mortgage, how tough it is to work 80 hours a week and maintain a marriage, how tough it is to raise teenagers and still maintain your sanity. If we talk about these things, we're in it together as a community, and it all becomes much more easy to deal with, right? We're on this journey together. So what do you think? What am I missing in all this? Is it too simple? I invite your thoughts. Give me a call at 781-3875 here on KCBX Public Radio. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, the Reluctant Therapist, with you today on Issues and Ideas. Coming up at 5 o'clock will be NPR's All Things Considered in 15 minutes. Till then, I invite you to call in with your thoughts and ideas on our subject of mental health and well-being and how we can improve our interrelationships and at the same time improve our own emotional health and not rely so heavily on outside experts or influences in telling us that we're okay. Coming up at 5 o'clock on KCBX, it'll be news from NPR's All Things Considered. Robert Siegel talks with two moderate Republicans, former Congressman Mike Castle of Delaware and Tom Davies of Virginia, about whether that wing of the party can actually survive. In years past, the party had a component referred to as Rockefeller Republicans, named after former Vice President Nelson Rockefeller. And that group actually tended to work well with middle-of-the-road Democrats. That story and more will be coming up in 15 minutes on All Things Considered here on KCBX Public Radio. Till then, I'm Elizabeth Barrett, the Reluctant Therapist, inviting you to call in and join our community. Join our conversation, 781-3875. You know, the World Health Organization defines mental health as a state of well-being in which each individual realizes his or her own potential, can cope with the normal stresses of life, can work productively and fruitfully, and is able to make a contribution to the community in some way. So what do you think about that? Kay Atascadero, thanks for calling in.
Oh, hi. Listen, I had my question for you is that on the spectrum of mental illnesses, are there certain ones, in your opinion, that would necessitate medication?
Absolutely, Kay. You know, 1% of our population needs medication at some point to get through a rough patch or to actually be able to function if, you know, there's some...
Right.
So I believe that, you know, there is absolutely, just like in our medical health, there are certain diseases that need medication in order for us to function.
Right.
My concern is that we've become so reliant on the quick fix promised by medication that we're now suffering, you know, the unintended consequences of all these medications we've put in our system.
Right. And misdiagnoses or what have you. But would you say something like schizophrenia, bipolar, and something like a personality disorder, are those some of the big ones that would require some medication initially?
Well, yeah, absolutely. You know, we need to help people get stabilized, and, you know, those have been the proven track record for those disorders.
Yes.
It's interesting, though, because I keep reading more and more about successful treatments. There's one called Open Dialogue. In Finland, where they're not using medications and they're doing a much more home-based presentation with the clients and having great success.
Oh, really?
Yeah, our farm-based program, there's some in the East Coast where people, you know, work and live on a farm and they're getting daily contact.
It's kind of like a modern-day sanitarium.
Exactly, but with a much more focused, you know, movement towards healing and not just kind of pushing people away.
But in defense
of the sanitarium, I have to say that for a lot of people, that opportunity to step away from their lives and regroup became very healing.
Oh, it is. I would love that right now.
I know how you feel. But yeah, I think that, you know, the key for this is, for me, is the piece that's been missing is that real personal connection. You know, whether it's low-level depression or high-level schizophrenia, to be able to have someone witness that experience and help us guide through our lives.
Absolutely.
Right. And that's what we're missing now. We've become very sanitized.
Yeah. You know, I was surprised because I checked out many books at the library, and that's exactly what the recommendation was, is that do not rely on medication alone. Make sure that you get some kind of proper therapy, blah, 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 blah.
It's all about the people.
But when you talk to some of the doctors and psychiatrists in person, that subject never comes up.
And I think part of the reason it doesn't come up is twofold. One, you know, we're very concerned about something happening to our clients and the professionals being blamed for that. So the first step is to always make sure we get everyone stabilized so that no one hurts themselves.
Right.
And I think with that kind of pressure, it's very difficult to say, hey, you know what? This isn't going to fix in 2 weeks.
Right.
It might take you 6 months to a year, but I suggest you go to the farm for 6 months. And people are going to say, I can't do that. I have to pay my mortgage, or I have to, you know, take care of my kids, or that's ridiculous. Give me a pill.
Right.
And so I think that's how we got into this, you know, this idea that we're not worth taking a step away from our lives for 6 months, or we fear taking that step away. So yes. I think that's how we got in trouble. But, you know, the more we're willing to say, maybe there's more than one way to live our life. Maybe there's one more way on this journey. Maybe that mortgage payment I'm chasing isn't worth my mental health and my family.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much for calling in.
You're very welcome. Thank you for taking my call.
Have a good day. Hey, Bob in Paso Robles, you're with the Reluctant Therapist. Thanks for calling.
Hi.
Hi. What's on your mind?
My question involves, people that are, you know, have relied on exercise for a long, long time to kind of be their therapist and, you know,
their guide.
And generate endorphins and whatever to make them feel stable, you know, and balanced. What can be done when, you know, the body starts telling you that, you know, you're not running 5 or 6 miles a day now, and you're not going to be able to, and you know, you're not going to be able to swim, whatever.
Right. How do we change that up?
Yeah, and how do you cope with the depression of this, you know, happening, and these abilities are going away when you know you're 60 or 65, and they're not going to come back.
So you're talking a little bit of the reality of aging, and how do we all cope with that?
Reality of aging.
And I think it's, again, one of those topics that we don't like to talk about because it makes us vulnerable, right?
Right.
The reality that death is the end of this journey for us all is something we're all really uncomfortable talking about. And
well,
so
I didn't want to go that far, but...
I'm sorry. But I'm a therapist, and that's where I go with these things because I think it's an important way to go about it, because the idea of our body slowing down and changing and us kind of hanging on to our,
right,
our way of life that we had forever until our slowdown... A way of dealing with that depression, the change, is to talk about some of the fears of what's coming up, because it's kind of fear based, right? If you knew, well, I can't swim anymore as much as I could, but I'm going to live to be, you know, 2000, I'd give up the swimming. But there's a little bit of that. I'm giving up the swimming, and what does that mean next? Because it's just all kind of give ups.
Mm-hmm.
And how do we transfer that to whatever that next piece of our life is? I think that's the conversation we have with our really intimate group of people that we talk honestly about aging with. Do you have that group? Most of us don't.
No.
Yeah, most of us don't have those people that we can actually say that. It's safe to talk about our exercise routine, but it gets a little scary when we start talking about, you know what, I can't run that 5 miles like I used to, and I'm a little concerned about what that means in the next 10 years. But
yeah,
I think
and the other thing is then you don't get the mental benefit of,
right,
of running, and so.
So where else
then,
do you find
then you
it?
Wonder, you know, what am I going to, what can I substitute to you know, have this balancing effect?
Right. And I think there are a lot of different ways you can substitute, but it's going to take, you know, creativity. Like if you couldn't swim your, 2 miles on your freestyle because your shoulder starts to hurt, how do you flip on your back and get excellent at the elementary backstroke for a half hour? You know, that there,
mm-hmm,
and it's being willing to discover within our bodies new ways to be.
Mm-hmm.
I hope that helps a little. But I really think the key is being able to have that open discussion with a couple trusted friends. And once you all start being able to say out loud, oh, God, I can't do that run either anymore, or oh, I'm really concerned about this, or here's how I've done it, it stops to have as much weight on our hearts when we realize everyone else is going through the same thing.
Okay.
I really appreciate your call, and let me know how things are going next month.
Okay. Thank you.
Hi, Liam in Santa Barbara. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi. Am I on?
You're with me, Elizabeth Barrett.
My name is Brooke. I'm calling from Los Osos.
Oh, hi, Brooke.
Hi.
Wrong person.
I'm a yoga instructor, mm-hmm, and I've never heard your show before, and I'm impressed.
Thank you.
Yeah. You're eloquent, and I appreciate it. There's like 16 things I want to say. You know, I think that one of the things that keeps people from talking about whatever it is that they're going through, you know, the stigma perpetuates itself.
Yes.
And it takes a lot of courage to break that stigma within oneself and advocate for the way people are living, the way people are surviving. I think it's fascinating that that people don't talk so much about the healing and recovery that comes from 12-step programs,
mm-hmm,
that the 12-step programs are specifically designed to kind of not share publicly but when you go into one of these programs, you find that people are sharing these things really vulnerable, but in a community that is supporting that that internal process that takes so much courage and so much commitment and discipline and focus.
And I agree. And I think that's one of the things that I'm trying to do is bring that discussion into the community more so that we don't feel like we have to be hidden in any aspects. You know, that amazing how much relief we feel in our bodies when we're able to find someone who's experiencing something similar in their lives, whatever it is, whether it's dealing with an alcohol issue or a parenting issue or, you know, struggles in our marriage. And I kind of go to the marriage piece because my heartache is how many marriages end quietly because the couple tries to work things out in their own home and everyone else saw them as the perfect couple until it all blows up. And if they had just said to their group of friends, oh my God, we're really struggling. It's hard being married. And the group of friends could say, yeah, it's hard for us. How do we support each other? What a difference that would make in a marital health.
Right. I agree.
Yeah. I appreciate you calling in and keep listening.
Thanks.
Have a good day. Our last call will be Jim from Paso Robles. How are you today?
Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi.
First of all, let me tell you, I really like your show. This is the first time I've seen it. I've heard it, too.
It's only our second time, so hopefully it's the beginning of something great.
Oh, good. Well, my question is, you mentioned that maybe 1% of mental problems need to be treated with drugs.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what the actual statistics are? How many people actually take drugs in the U.S.? Like psychotropic drugs?
I don't have the millions number. I just have the percent. And I know that we medicate 14% of our population. That's adults and children. So that's 13% roughly. And I don't know the numbers that are being medicated with very little success. Because that's the dark side of this is that just because you're getting medication doesn't mean it's actually working. And for an example, children who are on ADHD medication, it only works half the time with kids who actually need it. It works none of the time with kids who are medicated and don't need it.
Wow, that's an alarming statistic. That's about 15, 14 times more than your estimate.
Yeah.
But I would challenge the idea that this is an unintended consequence because it seems that Big Pharma are teaming up with psychiatrists and doctors to actually sell America on the idea that they can be happier when they take a drug. And it's just not true, and it's just putting money in the pockets of Big Pharma.
I know, and that, you know, I hate to think that there is a conspiracy between the big pharmas trying to get us all hooked on drugs. I think hopefully it's a little grander in the context of our culture where we as consumers who, you know, want to feel instant gratification and happiness, and we watch a lot of television commercials, and, you know, our whole mode of a culture is if it feels good, do it. I mean, we've bought in a little bit to this idea, and Big Pharma's just provided the journey.
Could be both.
Could be a bit of both.
There is a video on CCHR. It's Citizens Commission for Human Rights,
mm-hmm.
CCHR.org, I think. And it's called Making a Killing, and it tells exactly how Big Pharma has wheedled its way into our pocketbooks.
Absolutely. I appreciate that because that's not something I'm familiar with. I will take a look at it. But thank you very much for calling in and enjoy your day.
Yeah, thank you for your show.
Thank you. And I appreciate everyone who's called in and listened today. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, the Reluctant Therapist. And I just want to leave you with this idea that, you know, we have to define our own potential. We need to, as individuals, find out what we're capable of. Not everyone's going to have the same coping skills. Not everyone's going to have the same capacity for work or making a contribution to the community. Not everyone can work 80 hours a week and survive. Some people need to work part-time. You know, we need to look at our own abilities, our own capabilities to challenge ourselves in ways that we can meet our own potential. You know, a good therapist is a great guide for this journey in helping you discover your own optimal mental health. You know, ultimately, our journey toward mental health is our own. And that's time for us this week. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. If you'd like to continue the conversation, I invite you to join me on my Facebook page, The Reluctant Therapist. Next week on Issues and Ideas, you're going to discover some wines and winemakers from Paso Robles with travel correspondent Tom Wilmer. Also, learn about the upcoming Peace Love Story Fest as Marisa Wydell talks with storyteller and festival organizer Zett Harbor. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. I appreciate you listening to The Reluctant Therapist here on KCBX Public Radio.